Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to Matters of Life and Death. Thanks for joining us today. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim. Good to be here.
And we're really excited today to have a guest joining us as well, Tim Farron, MP. Tim, thanks so much for coming on the show. Would you mind by starting just quickly introducing yourself to those who haven't heard of you before?
Who am I? Well, I'm Tim Farron, and I am the Member of Parliament for Westmorland and Lonsdale, which, if that means anything to anybody, it is South Cumbria. It's the Lake District, bit of the Yorkshire Dales. Kendal is our big town. I've been the MP since 2005. I'm a Liberal Democrat. I was the party's president during our time in the coalition government and the party leader for the parliament just after that.
Brilliant. Well, we're really pleased to have you, such an experienced and interesting kind of Christian voice in parliament, in politics, to join us for this conversation. We wanted to start by talking about social media in politics. I don't know if you saw a story that was done by the BBC a few weeks ago, Tim, which was the kind of top line was that more than 3,000 offensive tweets are sent to UK members of parliament every day. This was an analysis of 3 million tweets aimed at MPs over a 6-week period, and it found that about 130,000, so that's 1 in 20, would be classified as toxic. Does that chime with your own experience? You're quite a kind of prominent on social media, shall I say, or a big user. Do you get inundated with kind of hateful, abusive messages?
It all depends. I think that women politicians get more grief than men. That definitely is the case, and indeed, people who belong to other minorities get grief as well. I think that it depends on what you mean by toxic. I mean, people saying things where they wildly disagree with you, using sometimes quite colourful language, is, would I call that toxic? It's not, you know, it's not a thing I'd like to do myself, but, you know, that's being challenged. Then there's stuff which is just downright abusive, and then there's the stuff that's violent. Over the years, there have been tweets that I've received and other communications that the police have considered to be a direct threat. But I think that on a daily basis, I don't feel I get that. But I'm not a woman. I'm not a party leader these days, so I don't tend to cause quite the same amount of offence as I did and wind people up. But also, I kind of hope that as a having done it for a long time, and B, as a Christian, that it's not water off a duck's back at all, but that I may be able to just deal with it in a way which is relatively healthy, but that does not make it all right.
Hmm. And why do you think politicians in particular have become such kind of an easy target for this? I mean, obviously social media can be quite toxic in other areas, but it seems like politics is a particularly kind of febrile, toxic atmosphere.
So the danger with all social media is that we live in bubbles and we think the bubble that we're in is the world, and it's not. Mm. Twitter is particularly attuned to people talking about public events of one kind or another, you know, shared events, and politics right at the heart of it. And very often you will talk critically, angrily about issues. And who are the people at the heart of those issues who are responsible for either sorting or not sorting out problems, or causing problems. It's the political operators, the actors themselves. So I think it's kind of understandable that we would be at the center of things. But people who are, in high profile media personalities and the like, sports people, they also attract a level of sort of derision and attention, which is not always healthy. But it is a window on what it's like for a lot of young people in the social media that they use, and the scrutiny that I see in my life is kind of, in a microcosmic way, something that every 13, 14 year old in the country deals with in a smaller way. You know, when I was 13 or 14 or 15 or 16, and I made a fool of myself over a girl or whatever, like, six people knew about it and it was shameful or whatever, but I got through it. Now the world knows about it. And we're not built for that. So I potentially, professionally, am kind of, you know, have the resilience to a degree to deal with it. But the other people don't, and younger people especially don't. And we wonder why there's an epidemic of mental health problems in our society. You know, Andy Warhol said in the future, everyone will be famous for 15 minutes. He was way off. Everybody in the future, everyone's famous all the blinking time. And they're therefore a performer all the time, to be judged and to be scrutinized all the time, to be shamed all the time. So, you know, what I deal with is just what kids are dealing with all of the time now.
So, Tim, can I ask you, I'm really interested in this because you've been around a long time like me, and therefore you must have done your early political career long before social media existed. So what was it like then? I mean, how did communication with the great general public happen? Did you get sort of letters with green ink? Or
Well, I mean, so one of the things that I feel most blessed about in my political life was I joined the Liberals one day at sixth form in my first couple of weeks there. The guy who signed me up happily connected me with what I will call a bunch of little old Methodist liberal ladies from Leyland, who were the ones who ran with the local councillors and their team of helpers. And it was a way of life to these people, but serving people, you know, face to face, not just waiting for election time, but getting out and knocking on doors and listening to people, holding street stalls and all the rest of it. And the public were encouraged to get in touch with this, you know, band of local councillors and their helpers. And so there was that kind of face-to-face stuff, which I do a lot of still. You know, I will knock on doors every week somewhere, you know, often without asking how they're going to vote. We just want to know what they're thinking about issues. And so face-to-face is the best thing still. You know, people will apologise to me when they come up to me in the supermarket and tell me stuff or ask me things for doing so. And I say, look, if people stop doing this, then I've got something to worry about. And so, the old school forms of communication were very, very effective and did the job. I think what social media does, in particular Twitter, but other things as well, they don't just let everybody's lives to be public, but everyone's a commentator. Everyone's an expert. Everyone has to have an opinion and share it. And so it encourages more of that. But generally speaking, I still deal with casework in a more direct way. So yes, electronic communications, but they'll be mostly by emails. And I think generally speaking, that's how people will get in touch. But no, we talk to each other. I think because of social media and because of online communications, I almost think that the old school ways of communicating, a bit of paper through a letterbox or someone standing on your doorstep, that makes them even more authentic and effective. So I try and do as much of that as I ever did.
I wonder whether you think that this kind of is inevitable, that when you gather a bunch of sinful, flawed human beings together onto a big international platform, there's nothing we can do to stop people ultimately saying horrible things to each other. Is this a problem of the kind of human heart, or are there things that the tech companies could do better? Is this a technology problem, or is it really about kind of character and sinfulness?
Well, if you had a pub and someone came into your pub, started using racist and offensive and, you know, just downright foul language, you have every right to kick them out. And so if someone comes into your internet pub, you own Twitter, for example, and they use offensive and unpleasant language and they're just rude to people, you know, you might be right to give them a couple of warnings, but you are not being a fascist. You are not clamping down on free speech, say, you know, not in my gaff, mate. Off you go. And so I think that, yeah, I think the internet giants absolutely do need to get a grip. It's hard to police millions of people chattering at each other all the time in time. But I also think that for us as Christians, it is an opportunity for us to be gracious and to act differently. And I try to, and I sometimes fail.
I'm really interested in this at a sort of slightly more philosophical, theological level, because what you said before, that, you know, when you had a problem with your girlfriend, about six people knew about it, now millions of people know about it. It says something, there's something about being human. The way we're created is that we're sort of embodied and physical, and that embodied physical nature actually acts as a limitation on what sin can do, on what, how far evil spreads. You know, if I say something really offensive to my friend, you know, it might go to a few people, but that's about it. But once you have this digital world, and you, it's like there's no, it's now not limited by the body. It's entered into this digital world, which means there's no limitation. This could go around the world. This, you know, something offensive said could impact literally billions of people. And that's just not the way the creation was meant to be. At least that's something I'm still sort of wrestling with, trying to get my head around. What does that mean? What do you think about that?
Well, look, I mean, the world is bigger in terms of people than it's ever been, and smaller than it's ever been, in the sense that, you know, you can say something here and it has an impact almost, or it may have an impact almost instantly on the other side of the world and affect millions of people. I think one of the other consequences is that it kind of devalues the discourse, because it's, there's so much of it that, you know, we always used to say, oh, don't worry, it'll be chip paper tomorrow about a bad headline in the newspapers. Well, it's like chip paper in 5 minutes. People have moved on to the next thing. What that tends to do is it increases people's, it lowers people's attention threshold, and it increases their tolerance threshold. And so, without wanting to get political too much, but an observation I would make in Western cultures, that political leaders now realize that if you can just, you know, refuse to take responsibility for a bad thing you have done for a few days, it will just go away. Everyone will get outrage fatigue because there's something else to get excited about. And if you can stick that out, then you survive. And so I think it means it's harder for justice to get done as a consequence. Having said that, it also means it's harder to hide away. And so we live much more exposed lives than we used to. And the odd thing is that Christians are often, you know, accused of being judgmental. But the reality is we live in a society which is super duper duper judgmental, with no possibility of grace or redemption. You know, so again, if you're outed for having said a thing or done a thing or having in the past been a thing that, you know, contradicts the kind of culture of the moment, and maybe rightly contradicts it, maybe it is a bad thing that you've done, said or thought, or what have you. But the idea that you could be redeemed or forgiven or, you know, accepted is alien. And then if anybody, you know, I would say from a liberal perspective, defends your right to have been and done and said that, or at least to offer the opportunity for them to have a second or third or fourth chance, then you are also cast out for defending the outcast. So I think that it's bizarre that a society that thinks it's irreligious is actually supremely religious and totally lacking in grace.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
I'm really interested in your kind of perspective as a Christian and a liberal on this question, because, I mean, you mentioned that you're quite kind of in favour of more kind of regulation, moderation from the tech companies. But what do you feel about government intervention in this area? Because you'll be obviously aware that the government, the Conservative government here in the UK, has got an online safety bill, which has been in kind of going batting around for a few years. And one of the big questions is trying to force the tech companies to be more robust on stuff which is legal but harmful. What's your kind of position on that, both as a Christian and as a liberal? Do you worry about that kind of overreach, or do you think that's healthy in kind of curating the conversation?
Well, look, I think so the great thing about being a liberal is that it's there's not a fixed position. You've just got to make sure you're always skeptical about power and people who have it. including you, if you ever have it yourself. But also, let's remember that there are freedoms from and there are freedoms to. And people who will often call themselves classical liberals only have half the story. You know, so I should be free to do X, Y, and Z. Yes, yes, yes. But a comprehensive liberal, and I would say that I'm a comprehensive liberal and not a classical one, is to recognise that we also need to have freedoms from. You know, the libertarian position, if you like, and more than a classical liberal one, is to say I should be able to do whatever I like. And the more rounded liberal position is to say, yes, so long as it doesn't harm others. And then you've got a difficult judgment to make. It's easy to be a libertarian, anything goes. Easy to be an authoritarian, you know, you do as I tell you. It's more complicated to be a liberal, where you say, yeah, anything goes up until the point where it conflicts with someone else's rights. And then you've got to have a real hard think about it. And it's tough having to think about it, isn't it? And so, you know, and it involves a judgment call and being wise, but that is what it is to be human. So I think the principles underlying the online harms and online safety legislation the government is introducing are kind of right. I think that there's no doubt. So let's be honest, we're talking about some really wildly dangerous stuff that encourages, promotes, and gives how to when it comes to self-harm or worse. And it also means access to pornography, particularly for young people. And we shouldn't be squeamish about saying that pornography is deeply wrong and deeply harming. It dehumanizes people, doesn't matter whatever age you are. But particularly for young people, it means that you objectify, whether you mean to or not, those people to whom you are attracted, often normally, but not always, the opposite sex. And you will find that you therefore inadvertently see them as being less than human. They're only there for you and not for having dignity in their own right. And so the idea that it's prudish to care about pornography is for the birds. If you care about humans, you should think pornography is deeply degrading. And you may well say, oh, well, I'm empowered to choose to take part in pornography myself if you are an actor in that. Yeah, but did you consult the rest of humankind, mankind, womankind? Did you consult them if it was all right with them, that you've objectified all of them at the same time? Don't give me this freedom baloney. And so I think that, you know, where does the state step in? That's a tough one. And I think at the very least we step in and say, you know, you have to protect people who are under 18 from this kind of stuff, because it is deeply harming. It affects people's mind, it affects people's relationships, affects their mental health, it degrades the rest of humanity. And it's an area where I think Christians and feminists, for example, many of whom might not be Christians, have absolute common cause. And we need to reach and establish those common cause, because we believe in dignity, we believe in equality, we think exploitation is wrong, and we think this stuff is harmful.
Some Christians, as you'll be aware, find the whole kind of swamp of social media, you know, people attacking each other, passing around graphic images, death threats, is so kind of irredeemable that they just want to quit and kind of call time on the whole thing. You've obviously chosen to stay on Twitter despite all this. What's your position on that? Do you think that it could come to a point where this online world is so toxic that it's actually not wise for us as believers to take part?
Honestly, Christian or not, you're not missing anything. If you just log off, cancel your account, and, you know, just do other things with your life, you're not missing anything. And I think that's the danger. People think that they're missing out. A small number, but I am coming across increasing small numbers of young people who just decided, that's it. I'm not going to use this anymore, and going back to, we'll call old school texts and just that kind of, you know, more personal communications. So I'm not saying you should all log off, but please don't stress about it. If you find this is just too upsetting, distressing, taking up too much of your time, because it can become an idol, by the way, being on this all the time, you know, you can become idolatrous behavior. So yeah, feel free to log off, switch off. You are missing nothing. If you're on it, let's make sure that we behave in a way which is gracious. If people are horrible to us, it's your opportunity to be kind and gracious back to them. And some basics, really. You know, you wouldn't drive after a glass of wine, so don't tweet after one either. You know, let's be cautious, let's be gracious, let's surprise people by being kind.
I'm just interested in where this is going, because it seems as though the trends are even getting more extreme, aren't they? I mean, TikTok is now the great new thing, and TikTok is just videos and very short snaps. It's as though this whole tendency to reduce life to these little digital snapshots, and yet with an enormous addictive potential. I'm just really interested to try to look forward to the future. Do you see? I mean, in theory, it seems to me, as Christians, we're not against technology, we're not against these kind of advances, but we recognise, we're also not naive. I mean, we recognise that there are enormous evil potential in this kind of technology. And from a spiritual point of view, you know, that evil forces can manipulate and twist and all the rest. Yeah. So the question is, how do we redeem it? How do we take this technology and pull it into a way where it really is reflecting kingdom values, it's doing something that's good, that's positive, that's beneficial?
Well, I think one thing just to say, obviously, you know, the development of technology is moving on at a geometric rate, if you like. It's the leaps and bounds that we're making is just, you know, would be unimaginable to the, you know, the 20-year-old me, even the 30-year-old me. But we're also not to kind of fall into the trap of thinking it's all going terribly, terribly, terribly wrong, or at least any more than any other era. So, you know, the title of my book and my podcast is It's a Mucky Business. Politics is a mucky business, but so is everything else since the fall. And so has every age since the fall, and we haven't to fall into kind of the kind of, if you like, the snobbery of chronology, as C.S. Lewis called it, where we think either that everything's great today and yesterday they were all stupid and backwards, or the opposite, that there was a golden age and that now everything's going terribly wrong. And I think neither of those things are right. As Christians, we need to take the culture as we find it, realize without wanting to be flippant that it all ends really, really well. God's sovereign. And therefore we need not worry. And we will be countercultural in every generation, And our job is just to keep focusing upon Jesus, seeking to live for him, seeking to be gracious, seeking to use the opportunity to share his word. And so, yeah, you know, every platform in existence ever is an opportunity for evil and for good. So we've got to use it for good, haven't we?
Yeah. What do you think about Elon Musk and Twitter? Because so on the one hand, you know, Twitter now is politically and in so many ways such an important part of modern life, yeah, and modern democratic institutions, and yet it's basically a commercial company designed to make, yeah, profit, and now it's been taken over by this very eccentric, unusual, and vastly wealthy man. What do you think about that? Do you think Twitter should be nationalized? Should it be run like the BBC? Should it? I mean, or
I think that would be nice, but that's not where it'd be good. I mean, it's a little bit like, you know, I use Twitter a bit in the analogy of it being like your local pub, and the landlord wouldn't allow, or shouldn't, you know, get every right to not allow people to behave badly within it. It's a little bit like your nice local pub being taken over by some big pub company. And you like the pub and you like the people, but
you're not sure about the management.
Yeah, the beer's changing a bit. And you don't like the jukebox. And so there comes a point where you think, you know what, we might go to another pub, but for the time being, we'll stay where we are.
I like that. You haven't created your Mastodon account as an escape last in case you have to bail on Twitter.
I have a feeling we've certainly downloaded all my data just in case. But I mean, you know, that he is a strange man with odd views is one thing. I mean, you know, but he owns it, he can do what he likes with it. And I suppose, yeah, so I would feel sad if it changed dramatically. Maybe as good an analogy as, you know, your football team being taken over by somebody horrible. Yeah. And, you know, and that does happen to people. You know, to people who are Newcastle United fans, that sort of, you know, you Manchester City fans, you know, you're all right with this then, are you? You know? And, you know, they're still wearing the blue or the black and white tops. And I mean, I'm a Blackburn Rovers fan and we're owned by chicken farmers who are all right, but they got no money. We used to be owned by Jack Walker, who was everybody's favourite, you know, club owner, you know, rich and decent, you know, so that's a rarity. But yeah, it's similar to that. You've got to, you know, do you decide to walk away from it? The time being, no.
Well, there's lots more to talk about politics and Christianity. We've run out of time for this first episode, but do come back with us next week when we're going to be resuming our chat with Tim Farron, talk about more about his politics and his politics podcast and book. But for now, thanks for listening. As always, you can get in touch with us by emailing molad at premier.org.uk, and we'll speak to you very soon next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.